Tonight, we're going to be in continuing to go through Genesis in the Old Testament. We're going to be in Genesis 13 and 14. And these chapters are focusing on the life of Abraham. His name isn't changed yet to Abraham. He still has his original name, Abram. We're in the second half of the book of Genesis. And this half covers four main characters. It's looking at the beginning of Israel's history, Abram, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And so we're still covering Abram. And in these two chapters, what we're going to be looking at is, in a sense, the opposite of Leo Tolstoy's book, War and Peace. I've never read that book. I know it's 1,300 pages or plus. But we're going to look at the opposite of that. We're going to look at peace and war. It's not 1,300 pages in my Bible, it's 2 pages. In chapter 13, we're going to look at Abram as a peacemaker. And in chapter 14, we're going to look at Abram going to war. He's going to battle. And it's interesting that when you look at these two chapters, we see a man who has discernment in knowing when it's right to avoid conflict or dispel conflict by creating peace and being a peacemaker. And in a sense, alleviating the conflict that existed in chapter 13. And in chapter 14, when he used discernment to know, here's a conflict that I need to become engaged in and involved in. And that requires a lot of discernment in our life. When are the times that we need to step back and step out and let somebody else prefer someone else? And when are those times in life where we need to step into something and take action? A lot of times we can do things backwards. We can mess things up. And I wanted to write on the board four boxes and kind of give you just as an intro to these two chapters that there's four ways to live. So you guys know back when you were in school, the XY graphs, right? So we're going to do a graph here. Four squares. And I'm sorry that I can't make this much bigger, but I'll try my best. So this bottom square line right here, we're going to put kindness. And the vertical, that's Y, right?
Yeah.
It's been way too long since I've done math of this kind. So on this side, we can put courage. So kindness going horizontal, courage going vertical. And in a sense, you could have peacemaking down here and trouble confronting up here with the courage. So there's four squares, and we're going to see Abram is in the square up here. You could put faithful. You could also say he is a person who has both courage and kindness. In chapter 13, we're going to see he demonstrates kindness. In chapter 14, he demonstrates courage. But in both ways, each chapter, he is showing faithfulness. That's one way to live. There's another way that people can live, and you could call them a fighter. They demonstrate courage. There's a degree of boldness in their life, but there can be a lack of kindness in their life. It would be a person who, in a sense, is an activist. They're very aggressive. It would be the person in chapter 13 who is fighting, and also in chapter 14 is fighting. Abram is willing to yield in chapter 13, and he's taking up conflict in chapter 14. So it's a different square. Another way that people can live is, you could say, a follower. Now you can see, in both fighting and following, it has an aspect of faithfulness, but it has an aspect of this other score that we haven't written down. A follower, you could say, is not an activist, but more of a pacifist. Person who's wanting to avoid conflict at all times and in every way. So this would be a person in chapter 13 who is conceding, who's willing to yield because they don't like conflict. So they're not getting involved. They're alleviating the conflict by just pulling out. And in chapter 14, they see the conflict and they don't get involved. So that's not what Abram is doing in these chapters. And then the last box, you could call the fool box. And the fool, you could say, is not the activist, not the pacifist, but the egotist, the person who's just thinking about themselves all the time. And they're the person who sometimes, really, the fool box has zero kindness and zero courage. It's the person who is getting involved in the wrong fights, and it's the person who is not showing any kindness in life. And so these are the four different squares. I think every person in life kind of has a default box. There's some people who are just more activists, and they're more interested in getting involved in conflicts and matters than what is necessary. And there's other people who are more the conflict avoiders. They just do not like conflict at all. What God wants us to do is he's, in a sense, we all start out down here, and then we can gravitate to one of these directions, but there's still a degree of foolishness in both of these. And what the gospel wants to bring us to is bringing up us up to the character of the Lord, faithfulness, which is what Abram is going to demonstrate in these two chapters. So in chapter 13, we'll look at him making peace and respecting Lot. Let's go ahead and we'll read verses 1 through 7. We'll see the conflict here. So verse 1. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. And Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. And he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. A little bit of background before we jump into these verses. In the previous chapter, Abram had arrived in Canaan. He had followed the Lord. He had trusted in God. He got there. God confirmed that he's on the right path. He said, "This land I'm going to give to your descendants." Abraham does not have any children yet, but he's trusting in God, and there's a famine in the land. And because of the famine, Abram decides to go down to Egypt. When he's down in Egypt, he's afraid that somebody is going to eye his wife, and so he comes up with this plan. Hey, babe, why don't, you know, as we cross the border here, let's pretend to be brother and sister as opposed to husband and wife, and then that way, you love me, right? And you don't want to see me die. So this way, my skin will be saved. And so they did that. And the Pharaoh was interested in her. He took her, but he didn't do anything with her yet. And then something happened. There was a plague. And Pharaoh realized there's something wrong here. And so the Lord watched out for the Abram and Sarah. And they left Egypt, but they left with a number of things. So they're coming out of Egypt. Abram failed in the last chapter. He failed to be a good husband. He failed to really stand up for his wife. But he goes back to the place where he had been following the Lord, and he returns from failure. There's a rebound in his life, and he makes an altar again, and he calls on the name of the Lord. Verse 5, Lot also, who went up with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. So this conflict occurred after returning from Egypt. Probably part of the reason why they have so many possessions is because they acquired more stuff when they were down in Egypt. And so Abram could be looking at, you know, the Egypt situation and thinking, look, even though it was bad, God kind of, I got some stuff out of it, and so it's good. But you can see in this chapter, there's a problem because of the stuff, the added stuff to his life. We're going to see later, this is a problem in Lot's life. They acquired a female servant when they were down there in Egypt, and that is going to be a problem when we get to chapter 16. So there's a lot of baggage that he brought back that is going to plague him for a little while. But they are back in the land, and the conflict is over stuff. And when you think of conflicts in life, how many fights in this world are over stuff? Over things, over possessions, over money. Here is a situation where they have too much to be able to dwell next to each other. They both have livestock and animals, and there's only a limited space of grass because they've got neighbors around. And so somebody needs to move. There's not enough space for them. And so we've got this conflict over stuff. And there are some things, some arguments in life that if you step back and take some time to think about, if I just remember it at the end of the day, it's stuff. It's not really that big of a deal. I remember a number of years ago, my parents had a few different bed frames that they had acquired at different times. And so as each of the kids were moving out of the house, they got to choose, you know, one of these bed frames to take. And there was one particular bed frame that I kind of liked over a different bed frame. And one of my brothers liked that same bed frame as well. And since I was the oldest, I got to have first pick, and so I picked this bed frame, and it's still just a bed frame. And my one brother, he was kind of upset at the time, and since then, I'm pretty sure he's long forgotten or gotten over it. But, you know, nowadays, I look at the bed frame, and it's a nice bed frame, but it's just a bed frame. And it's not even my wife's favorite bed frame in the house, and so, like, if my brother wanted it, he can have it. And there's just different things where we get in arguments over stuff. I have an aunt whose aunt recently passed away. And so this great aunt, it's not related to me, it's just her aunt. But we were helping clear some stuff out of the house with her and moving a piano. And she was giving us some advice. Like, if there's things, because she was the executor of this estate, and she kind of thought that everybody would kind of get along. And she said, if there's certain things, you know, basically, if you have a will, first of all, make sure you have a will. And then second, if there are specific things that you want to go to specific people, write it down. And I guess there wasn't a lot of specifics in this will, and so there was a lot of conflict. And it's sad when a person passes away, that can be a tragedy, but you can have even a tragedy beyond that of the internal conflict and fighting afterward. And we have a conflict here over stuff, over things. And the thing that Abram is aware of, which we're going to see here pretty soon, but in verse 7 it says, the Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. So there's neighbors around. Abram and Lot are relatives. And there's fighting going on, not at the point right now when it's between Abram and Lot, but it's between their herdsmen. And there's neighbors that are watching, and they're supposed to be Christians. They're supposed to be followers of God, and there's all this infighting. And so it's good for us to remember regarding the fights within a church or the disagreements or the arguments. We've got a world that's watching the church. Now, there are some fights that we need to be faithful to take a stand on. There are some things that we can't compromise on. But there are so many other things that we can lovingly prefer and realize, hey, we are brethren. And that's what Abram gets to in the next verses. He has a conversation with Lot. So verses 8 through 13. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted his eyes and saw the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go down towards Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Then Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. So we have here this conversation. Abram goes to his nephew, and he says, hey, we're brethren. He remembers their family bond. And I appreciate this because he is doing this because relationship was more important to him than stuff. And I know this because if stuff was more important to Abram, what would he have said to Lot? He would have said, go west, young man. He would have said, you've got to find your own spot because I'm the patriarch. I'm the oldest here. God told me to come here. You are just tagging along. You got to go find your own way in life. And yet he didn't say that to him because stuff wasn't most important. The land wasn't most important. His relationship with his nephew and the relationships around him were more important. In Psalm 133, there's a psalm just about the blessing of brethren dwelling together in unity. And also in John chapter 17, Jesus' prayer for his church. He prays over and over again that they would be unified, that they would be one, like Jesus and the Father and the Spirit were unified. So Abram prefers his nephew. He gives him first choice. And what Lot should have said in this situation is, uncle, you're older than me, and you actually get to pick first, and put it back on him. So both of them could have been gracious in this situation, but Lot doesn't do that. He says, I get first choice. And so he surveys the land, and he sees what's best. Kind of like, you know, my boys, if I have two pieces of cake, what are they going to look for? If I give them first choice, they're going to look for what's best for them, just because that's human nature. That's just, even as we get older, we try to conceal it a little bit, but we still think those thoughts inside until the Lord's transforming us. And so Lot sees what he perceives as best for him externally, physically, financially. He sees the land near Sodom and Gomorrah. He says it's like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. So he compares it to Egypt. He's kind of gotten a taste of the world, and as he's left Egypt, he's wanting that again. And so he sees this land that's like that, and he picks it. He chooses it rather than preferring his uncle. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 4, we're told, let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. That's what Abram is doing. That's not what Lot is doing. And then also in James chapter 3, talking about wisdom from above, it says the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Jumping to chapter 4, verse 1, where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. And so Lot has the mentality of the world. He's choosing what he thinks is best for himself. But in verse 13, it says, the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. So he pitched his tent next to great wickedness. And he's thinking, well, this is going to be all right because the land's good. And it makes me think, just how do people in our culture make decisions today regarding where they're going to live, regarding what they're going to pursue? Is it purely economical? You know, when people get a job offer, do they look into the churches that are in the city or the town? Do they look into the spiritual environment? That's not to say that you can't move to Seattle or to San Francisco, which are very exceedingly secular cities, or Olympia, for that matter. God can enable a person to thrive even in a worldly environment. I think of Jonah, who is called to go to a secular environment to be a witness and to be a light and to proclaim. I think of Daniel, who was taken to Babylon, and how he was able to be a witness and a light. But here, that's not why Lot is making this move. He's not thinking, I'm going to be a witness. Now, secondhand, he might be trying to justify his reasons, like I can be a witness here. But that's not his heart reason. That's not his real motivation. And his real motivation is just his material gain. and he's going to lose his family as a result of this decision. So Lot is contrasted from Abram. I appreciate a quote by Warren Wiersbe. He said, "The eyes see what the heart loves." What did Lot see? He saw what his heart loved. What did Abram see? He saw what his heart loved. He saw Lot. He loved his nephew. He saw the Lord. He's trusting in the Lord, which was enabling him to prefer. And then we see, after Lot moves and takes what in his mind is the best, the Lord comes to Abram in verse 14. "And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, 'Lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward.'" What does that include? The land that Lot just chose. God said, "Look all directions, for all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever." In other words, Lot is just renting territory from Abram at this point now. "Everything belongs to Abram, and I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you." Then Abram moved his tent and went and dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Lord. And an altar is just a picture of him worshiping the Lord, dedicating his life. Jump over to Matthew chapter 5. I would like to look at one cross-reference here. Matthew chapter 5, verse 5. This is in the Sermon on the Mount, a section called the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are basically characteristics of the Christian. And the third beatitude that Jesus mentions here, he says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Now, I think it's unfortunate in the English language that meekness rhymes with weakness, because I think a lot of times people associate those two, but they're not the same. I think some people would look at Abram's actions right here in Genesis chapter 13 as he's being weak, but he's actually not being weak. It takes great strength to do what Abram just did and prefer his nephew. And meekness actually means strength under control. It was used to describe stallions who had been broken. And there was a rein now that could be over them. And there was an ability to be able to take all of that strength and have it be guided by a person, another individual. And Abram is allowing his life to be under the control of the Holy Spirit, under the control of God. God has given him strength. God has given him power, but he is allowing that power to be used and exercised in a way that is appropriate and right. And when you think of the world, I think the world does not see this verse and think that it makes much sense. I think even in our political system right now, I'm not going to name names, but you know what happened this week with one particular presidential candidate who's kind of jumped up towards the top in their political party. I think meekness is one of the words that would be the very antithesis of who this person is as an individual. I don't think there's much strength under control or willingness to demonstrate a gentle. Another word for meek is gentle. Attitude. And I think the world looks at, you gotta push yourself forward. You've got to just be aggressive and fight. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to get anywhere in life. And here, the Lord is saying, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." At the end of the day, at the end of the world, at the end of the age, when eternity kind of clicks over from time in the present to forever with God, it will be the meek who inherit the earth. It will be those who trusted in God who will get to enjoy those possessions forever and ever and ever. And This isn't to say that people who are following God can't have possessions and can't have stuff nowadays and have, you know, space in the world right now. But Abram is taking the long-term view in life, and he's trusting God, and he's just resting in God's provision and God's inheritance for him, that we have an inheritance that's undefiled, incorruptible, reserved in heaven for us. In Galatians chapter 3, chapter 1, verse 3, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus." Also in verse 11, "In whom we have obtained an inheritance, being predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will." So before we move into chapter 14, I think it's good for us to just consider, are there any conflicts in our life right now that are over stuff? And are we taking the long-term view or the short-term view regarding that stuff? Is it worth the fight, or is there an opportunity to demonstrate meekness and be willing to yield? That doesn't necessarily mean that we let people walk all over us. When Jesus talked about turning the cheek, in that culture, it meant basically continuing to pursue friendship with that person. It doesn't mean you become a doormat. I think sometimes people think of turning the cheek, you know, as becoming just weak and you don't stand up for yourself. But what it means is you're continuing to pursue friendship with a person, even in the midst of sometimes needing to stand up. So let's jump into chapter 14 and we'll see another aspect of Abram's life. Verse 1, "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Adamah, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these joined together in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea, near the Dead Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and the 13th year they rebelled." So you've got four kings from the area of Persia and Babylon that had come over and had fought with these five kings. And they put these five kings under subjection, and so they had to pay tribute. And after 12 years, these five kings decided, we're tired of paying this tribute to these four kings who are foreigners, and so we're going to stop. And they quit. So in the 13th year, they rebelled. In the 14th year, these four kings decided, we want our stuff back. We want that tribute. So they came to the land to conquer these five kings again. Verse 5, "In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim." And this word Rephaim in Hebrew, it's speaking of giants. "In Ashtoreth, Carnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shavah, Kiriathaim, and the Horites in the mountain of Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness." Just a little side note, if you jump over to Genesis or Deuteronomy chapter 2, you have all of these individuals, these nations mentioned, and they're all giants. They're all like super races. And these five kings come in, and on their way to attacking these four kings come in, on their way to attacking these five kings, they overcome all these giant races. And they're kind of conquering along their way. And so these are not weak kings. They have a lot of power. And then they come to the five kings. Verse 7, "Then they turned back and came and attacked the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed." So now you see why this is mentioned, because Lot is involved. In the previous chapter, where had Lot been? Outside the city, pitching his tent toward the city. So every morning he can wake up, he can go outside his tent, and he sees the city that he's attracted to. And where is he now? He's moved inside the city. So he's starting to get pulled in. He's compromising. Later, we're going to see he is sitting in the gate of the city. He's part of the leadership of the city. That just more and more in his life, he is just getting sucked into this. But he got taken into captivity with these others. Verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. And the term Hebrew can mean outsider or foreigner. For he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother had been taken captive, if you're Abram, what would you have done in this situation? If you're a little bit bitter about chapter 13, you would have thought, well, that's his own fault. Like, serves him right and teach him a lesson. But he doesn't do that. It says he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house, and he went in pursuit as far as Dan. Dan is over 100 miles away. So he took 318 guys with him, and he went on this march over 100 miles to go attack these four kings that had just beat five kings and had beat giant nations. So we've got this little posse. It's kind of like a, I don't know, Robin Hood situation or something. And so he's got 300 guys. And I think it's significant. Abram is a peacemaker, but he's also a person who has armed servants and trained servants. And I don't think that there's a conflict between that. I don't think being a peacemaker is being a complete pacifist at all times. I think that you can be a peacemaker where you're pursuing peace, but there are times where it's right to go to war, where it's right to stand up and conflict, to defend. And if you look at Abram, the reason why he's doing this isn't for his self-interest. He's taking great risk upon himself. He's doing this for the sake of his nephew, Lot. So he went as far as Dan, verse 15. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus, which is another 20, 30 miles past that. So he brought back all the goods, and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shavah, that is the king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, this is a different king, mystery man, brought out bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him, and he said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tithe of all. So we've got this mystery king. There's not much that's said about him in the Bible. About 1,000 years later, David writes about this guy in one psalm, Psalm 110. And then about 700 years later, the author of Hebrews writes about this guy, Melchizedek, in the middle of that book. And he talks about how Jesus is connected to Melchizedek. Now, there's some people who think that Melchizedek is Jesus in the Old Testament. There's some people who think Melchizedek is a picture of Jesus or a type or a forerunner. Which is it? I don't know. And maybe we'll kind of unravel that a little bit, talk about it when we study Hebrews sometime. But one of the purposes of Melchizedek is he's giving perspective to Abram in this situation. There's a lot of parallels. He brings out bread and wine. Picture of communion. Think of Jesus in the New Testament. It says he blessed him, and he said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High." The person who blesses is greater than the person who's blessed. So this person is saying he's greater than Abram, who is the greatest person in Israel as a nation. And Abram recognizes that, and that's why he gives him a tithe. He gives him a tenth of what he has. First time tithing is mentioned in Scripture. And so he demonstrates a trust that this guy is great and acknowledges him. Now, in verse 21, the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons and take the goods for yourself." So this man is willing to give to Abram some of the spoils of the battle. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted up my hand to the Lord God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth." He's using something that he had just heard from Melchizedek, that God is a possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap or a shoelace, that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, "I made Abram rich," except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Ashkol, Mamre, let them take their portion. So Sodom here, the king of Sodom, it sounds like he's trying to be generous to Abram and saying, "Here, why don't you have some of the stuff?" And Abram knows there's strings attached to these gifts that Sodom is giving. And it's almost a bribe. It's a form of allegiance. And I want to have nothing to do with Sodom. And I think what enabled Abram to say no to these possessions was he realized God is the possessor of the heavens and the earth. And God has given me enough. And I don't need what this world is offering, that the Lord has given me contentment and what he has given to me. And so we will talk a little bit about this more when we get into chapter 15, because after Abram leaves this scene, there's some fear in his heart. There's probably a little bit of fear of two things. He just defeated four kings. Are they going to come back after him? He's got only 300 guys. And he just said no to a number of possessions to a powerful king in the nation. And is he burning a bridge there that he maybe should have kept? And we're going to see God comes in and affirms his heart and encourages him that he's doing everything right. But as we wrap up tonight, I can think of another person that is like Abram, only better. Person who is a peacemaker and also a trouble confronter. And think of Jesus in his first and his second coming. In Jesus' first coming, what did he ride into Jerusalem on? A donkey. And what was the symbol of a donkey in that time period? It was a symbol of a king coming in peace. Jesus came to bring peace between God and man. That's why he came in his first coming. He came laying down his interests, laying down his rights, preferring the will of his Father and preferring the need of mankind to his own interests. But there will come a time that Jesus won't come as riding on a donkey. He won't come laying down his life as a lamb, but he will come riding in on a horse. And what was in that culture riding in on a horse symbolizing? Conquering, a victor. And Jesus will come in the second time as a lion. And so we see God and his nature. He is both courageous and he's kind. He's both of these things. And that's why he calls us in life to be faithful, to be courageous, and to be kind. To not be people that are just antagonists and activists and always picking a fight. Not to be people that are always avoiding a fight. But being people that are realizing which fights are worth fighting, which fights are worth yielding and preferring others. And as we just close, I want to encourage you with one question. Which is your default box? The Lord wants to bring us here, but where do we kind of naturally tend to be? And then how do we get to these positions? The Lord, he wants to allow the nature of Christ to come into us more and more and more and be able to demonstrate that. And it's through the gospel, it's through grace that we can become more courageous and more kind. So we're going to close in prayer. It is the National Day of Prayer, and I thought it would be good to spend a little bit of time praying. So let's just go ahead and pray as a church body. If you have something you'd like to pray for, It can be relating to the message. It can be relating to just our nation and praying for our leaders, praying for our future leaders. And after a little while, I will close and then we'll end with one song.